Okay, so this morning's title is somewhat ambitiously, What Have We Learned? And Bob and Billy and I are going to say a few things, but we don't actually have a synthetic answer. And part of what I have in mind is to get some feedback from the group. This program began with a sort of brainstorming session in which people said, were asked, what are the things you'd like to get out of this program? What are the pressing theoretical or experimental technical problems? And we made a list and put on the board and actually got onto the website. And so if we have some kind of output like that, we might similarly take some pictures of the lists that we develop, if any, recognizing that we don't have nearly the critical mass that we had at the outset. One of the key questions in our minds, so I'll just go first. One of the key questions in our minds came up yesterday, which is, how can we describe how can we decompose or dissect the ecological components of what's going on in a tumor, both pre and post treatment, from transient processes that have to do just with adaptation to changing environments? And so, you know, Sharad put up the figure yesterday from his analysis that showed these progressive waves of groups of mutations traveling through the population. And I was struck by the similarity to this figure, and I thought it would be worth bringing this kind of work to the attention of this community. So this figure comes from this paper here. I mentioned Greg Lang yesterday. He's a new assistant professor at Lehigh. He stands in direct opposition to Richard Behe, who's a creationist at Lehigh. Greg's an evolutionary biologist who trained with Michael Desai and David Botstein, and for part of his postdoctoral work, they did this experiment. They finished this experiment. So what they've done here is to evolve. They started with something like 600 replicate populations, half of which were passaged every day. They're growing in 96-well plates, and every day with the robot, they made 100-fold dilution into sterile media. And they just let that go for something like, I'm going to guess, 600 generations, something like that. So, and I can't tell you off the top of my head, although it's obviously described here, what the details of the media into which the yeast was diluted, but it was somehow an environment that was at least somewhat novel to this genotype. And then for this paper, so they did that experiment and described change in fitness. So this is the classical Richard Lenski E. coli experiment in the modern high throughput form. And so what they did here was to do deep sequencing on a subset of populations fairly densely. So here are the generations. So actually, you can see they ran in 1,000 generations. They picked 6 representative populations. 3 of them were larger, by which they meant that the dilution was the population size was larger. The dilution was not as severe and smaller. The dilution was a bit more severe, and they just tracked the frequency of every mutation they see. And so what you see here is a pattern that looks very much like the pattern that we saw in Sorab's figure. But the important point that I want to make is that our understanding of what's going on here is really just adaptation to a new environment.
Am I interpreting this correctly to say that this is, I'll pull Jessica here, those are phenotypic, you know, alignment? So common phenotypes from a variety of different genotypes to get the same similar patterns occurs?
There's very little knowledge or understanding of the phenotypes of these guys.
So the mutations that travel together are, because it's asexual, they're just traveling together. So they could be all substance passenger mutations. One of them is some anyway.
But they're traveling together in the same frequency.
Yeah, so
they will if they're in the same cell. So it's exactly analogous to what Sharad was saying yesterday. So it's basically, they just travel together because of genetic linkage. It's only one that is functional. And it's hard to then know which.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, no fewer than one, but surely not all are functional. So this is some evolutionary opportunity, some beneficial mutation increases in frequency. It appears on a background that already has a bunch of mutations. They also increase in frequency because there's no genetic recombination, so they just go along for the ride, just like in formal expansion in the tumor. And then it's displaced by this thing.
which is another good idea, apparently a better idea, because this thing seemed to go back down, and then this thing started to come up, so we can guess that this is going to go down if the thing were continued. So, they see it in large populations and small populations, and they can actually estimate selection coefficients from these slopes here speak to the selection coefficients. And so there's quite a lot of information in these deep sequencing studies of these populations that are being grown in an environment that is as static as can be managed in the laboratory.
This is the Lang paper, and then you said there's a...
This is the Lang paper, Lang et al. I misspoke last night. It's in Nature. And then David Gresham at NYU has work that's worth looking into. I'm not sure how much of it is published. And then Sasha Levy was a postdoc with Gavin Sherlock at Stanford, and what Sasha did was to build a library of these strains that are isogenic except for a barcode. I think there was something like a 100,000 or 50,000 barcodes, distinct barcodes, so they just throw them all together, they make this library, they just throw them together, they do deep sequencing on day one at the barcode locus to get the relative frequencies, and they just watch the change over time. And they're rebuilding the thing to have 10 times or 100 times as many barcodes now. But qualitatively, I think the results, I mean, for the purposes of this group, these results tend, I think, are strongly analogous. Yeah?
So essentially, the point here is it's one environment, constant environment, and you see all that stuff going on, all these trajectories happening. And what we yesterday discussed, Bob was saying that we see that possibly seven niches where the cell lines go in this beam paper. And so I guess part of the challenge here is that, and I've seen this in these 2 weeks, between the, let's say, people who like to think mostly on the phenotypic level versus people who look at the genetic data, molecular data, there is a data imbalance, essentially, at the moment. Because I think it's well highlighted by Thorov from yesterday. He essentially has access in two of xenograft models to dynamics that is happening in the population. And to start systematically studying the phenotypic adaptation and then pull out, maybe it's only three niches that there are, we need to somehow collect similar quality data for the phenotypes, and I think that seems to be a big bottleneck. So Joe Gray's talk, I think, was very promising to that extent. But I don't know what are the best ways to get there. We do need data of this kind from the cell phenotypes and to start ruling out some of that let's say your take is all we need seven niches. Dan is putting here forward one is enough, and probably it's somewhere between what's happening. So but we can say that based on the picture like this, because this is consistent with the constant environment, I guess. So I guess what is the data type that we should collect from the cells?
So if I'm understanding you, and I might not, so a question and a statement all wrapped up in one. If you had the potential, let's say, to establish seven different environments that you could maintain statically the same way that this experiment was, and you took a population of cells and simultaneously maintained them in those seven different environments, and then watched how that influenced the emergence of different clones, you would be getting the data that you wanted? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I think the genetic data, we know how we get it. So but we would get, but we would need, I think we would need some way of, let's say, Bob has this very nice idea of game theory with the prostate, the three layers, essentially, three cell types. I think to make that work quantitatively, we probably want to somehow keep monitoring of those cell populations. And I don't know how to do that. But in I think you could set up the experiment. I think people are doing that, right? There are these mixed experiments with ecological images.
Right. Let's start from the other end of the telescope. Suppose I looked at these data and having spent a lot of time thinking about ecological theory and game theory and stable coexistence and so on, if I looked at this, I might be inclined to think that my reaction might be the same as Bob's yesterday, which is that, well, there must be two alternate opportunities here. They're not exclusive to each other. So then if this were my experiment, my approach would be to fish one of these out and start characterizing their phenotypes. Maybe this is secreting something that this can metabolize or something. There's even in the I've referenced this sort of Ur experiment in my community, Rich Lansky's experimental evolution lines in E. coli. Just for, if you don't remember, don't know, he started with a single clone of E. coli 25 years ago, made 12 replicate lineages in flasks, and has propagated them ever since. There's 60,000 generations. And there have been times in that experiment within some flasks where there's stable coexistence of two ecological types. So we, with our clumsy fingers and crude vision, see a flask that's shaking and presume it's one environment, but that's not true. So I would like to then go after these guys and figure out what they're doing differently. And so at least for me, the killer experiment is to try in a xenograph model or something to try to isolate particular cells and characterize their
but then wouldn't it be helpful to alter their environment and see whether or not you could separate their sort of, so if they function equally or synergistically or whatever the appropriate term is in this environment, that's one piece of data.
Right.
Now, I mean, if these were tumor cells, yeah. What if you now put them in the presence of endothelial cells, right, and only one of them?
Right. So in other words, you would take a slice from here and move it into a second environment.
Yeah, and move it into a second
environment. So that would be super. And I mean, Sharps describes data like that, where they go and they do replicate xenografts of second and third generation tumors. So you could imagine putting it into a different mouse or a different tissue type.
Yeah,
I'm not this kind of biologist.
Right,
so
I think you could do multiple things, including xenografting, but then different co-culture
and models. And see whether their frequency, I mean, they're highly repeatable.
Yes.
When you go into the exact same environment, so how does it change?
I think what's interesting about these figures, so if you look at the top left, there's a curve that peaks and then it comes back down again.
Mm-hmm.
The decline slope is associated with the increase of the emergence of the other. The one on the right, the top right, actually has these kind of successive waves. So that has to be hierarchical.
They're nested.
Yeah. So the second curve that goes up inherits from the first, and then.
But it doesn't, because it doesn't have, these are mutations.
Yeah.
And they're not present in these guys.
Because it's mutation frequency.
It's fixed already.
So I see.
It's really some, you know, clonal expansion.
Yeah, analogous to literature. So I think these patterns, so the top left suggests competition, whereas the top right suggests increasing fitness by acquiring additional mutations.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
I see an important difference, but they both seem to me to exhibit increasing fitness, right? I mean, this is.
They do, but there's not the concept of coexisting on the top right.
I see, right.
Yeah, in the first case, it's a classic example of one outcompeting another.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The second one is just sequential fixation.
Yeah.
Almost in every lecture, somebody was asking a question of whether there is actually competition,
right,
or just sort of exponential inflation
in all the players,
and then some sort of local perhaps adaptation, so of course divergence, which will happen on different branches of exponentially expanding tree, and then sort of local adaptations perhaps to different niches.
So let's say, for example, like a peak of top left.
Yep.
What introduces a drug.
Yeah.
And then you see that response. Then you could actually make an association between sensitivity and resistance.
Yeah, and you'll have those data.
Hopefully. Not yet, so far.
Yeah, if you guys, if your colleagues can get the dosing ready. So I just wanted to bring this to our attention. And the key difference is that these are transients. And the ecological framework presumes that things are at some kind of equilibrium, and it's, as Billy says, it's an open question. So one challenge in my mind is to disentangle those two compelling hypotheses.
So what ways do we have to collect innovative data of cell populations? This Joe Gray was on some really nice high content image, and that looked to me that it's not yet level enough. Will not be anytime soon. It was quite impressive what you missed the result. What other options? What's your, in your Frostbed study, what's the feedback that you get from, like, when you monitor how it's working, can you actually get a handle of the proportions of those three cell types?
We can infer it, that's all. I mean, we basically perturb the system and see what happens. And, you know, if we know the perturbation is directed toward one of the populations, infer how much of the tumor was, you know, that subpopulation. It's not easy. I mean, we were just talking about this, that that we've put in a grant, they actually have a computationally guided tumor board where we do just this sort of thing, develop models, design protocols based on computational models where the models can inform the oncologist about best therapy at every given time point. And these tumor boards now start to bring in, you know, physicists and computational models and applied mathematicians as well as the traditional medical tumor boards. And so the idea that every patient is treated continuously by continuously updated computational models. So you give, you know, your first set of drugs, you see what happens to whatever your biomarker is, and then you feed that back into the model, and the model is telling you this is what the perturbation did and that what we think will happen next. And also against what you predict. That would be a radical. That's a radical change in the way, you know, tumor boards are typically run, and obviously it will just be a small portion of the patient.
It somehow hinges on you getting information about the prevalence of those cell populations. So it feels that you need to do lots of inference on that. I feel that should be technologically soluble.
I'm sorry.
That we would have good measurements of those numbers, yeah. And then comes the modeling, rather than we have to invest a lot of assumptions and things to get an idea of those numbers.
Well, I think it has to go hand in hand. In other words, you've got to do the models based on what you have, because that's all you have, and see if it works. If it doesn't work, then you have to start saying, well, okay, I need this data. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, how, you know, weather forecasting has developed over centuries. I mean, it's started very crudely with very limited assumptions and very limited data, and then developed in, as you've got better, you know, first principles, you got better data sets and then computational programs so we can't, I mean, and I keep saying is that if we can't know where to go until we take the first step, and the first step means that we've got to take what we've got and use it as best we can and see if it works, and then start to see where we need to do things. I mean, if the GU oncologist would just get PSA every 3 weeks, I mean, instead of, you know, once in a while, which is kind of the way it's done, I mean, that alone would give us a data set that has a regular time interval. That alone would be, I think, very helpful. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to look at circulating tumor cells. But it's helpful then to look at the circulating tumor cells in the context of a model. As opposed to just, I think often we just get data because we get data, not because it actually is informing anything. So the goal really is like the physical sciences, where you the models, the theoretical piece moves hand in hand with the experimental piece, as when there's a mismatch or when the theory needs additional data, it can, we can ask experimentalist clinicians to get that data. So I mean, that's kind of the idea. I don't think we will, I mean, unless we get just dynamite new drugs, I think we will only make progress if we recognize that we're dealing with a complex, adaptive, open system. And and those are, like the weather, need to be treated computationally. But that, you know, I think that it used to be thought that the complex dynamic systems are essentially not, you can't do anything with them, but I think that there's now some emerging conceptual models that suggest that by understanding the dynamics and applying forces that that are consistent with this, you can guide it along. And that's kind of the approach that we would like to take.
We did have your hand up. Trent, or is that also Trent's answer?
I guess originally hand went up for you were talking about the Gervais and the phenotypic diversity, and I was trying to remember whether Joe actually talked about fish, but not DNA fish, RNA fish. So, you know, to what extent one can assess phenotypic diversity sort of in situ by looking at a bunch of suitably selected probes, right? And I guess one can wash it in and out, and should be able to get some pretty good view of heterogeneity, at least in the level of expression, right? And I assume people are doing what I'm
so single cell RNA-seq is actually possible.
Yeah.
So you don't even have to know what you want to probe for. You can
well, except then you dissociate the thing. So if you actually do it in situ, then
No, but you could do it spatially. You do laser capture.
So laser capture. Okay.
Laser capture single cell RNA-seq is being worked out.
And so this would be a xenograft. Model.
You can do this from human specimens that are actually, been fixed. I mean, they're
so you get a biopsy and then go to work.
Mm-hmm. But I think it comes back to the, I mean, that's just a snapshot, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it comes back to this problem of being able to add in the dynamics if you were really going to apply these models
like this.
Yeah. And that's so, that's a problem.
So there was, there was this crazy idea, right?
Yeah.
one of the postdocs here is working on this. So the question is, if you have this snapshot, and suppose somehow by hook or by crook, you actually knew lineage of cells. Right. So let me give you a little toy, for example. In the dish, right, you can grow a little microcolony, make a nice smoothie and phase of it, and track cells, segment it, and you'll know exactly who the daughters are.
Who begat whom.
Who begat who, who are second cousins, who are third cousins. Right? So now, take a snapshot with fish, right? You know, of course, I should back off and say that what's being studied here is, at least, the idea is to almost to study epigenetic dynamics, right? So you're looking at something, and particularly this is done in stem cells, right? So you're looking at 10 generations, and you're looking at some markers that are heterogeneous, and with live reporters, you will see just temporal fluctuations. So some stuff goes up, goes down. Take a snapshot, you see heterogeneous population. Now the question is, given the lineage and the snapshot, can you learn something about the dynamics? So the answer to that, at least in this little in vitro setup, the answer to that is yes. you can with some suitable model, simple but reasonably general, reconstruct something about dynamics. So then, of course, the next question is, if you can't really watch the cells, how can you reconstruct the lineage? And I think Allen Institute is quite interested in sort of devising ways of tracking lineages and reconstructing lineages. So I guess one way of reconstructing a lineage, right, Darryl here was talking about using methylation trend. So, and certainly if one can, okay, so here is a dream experiment. So suppose one could combine this phenotypic fishing study with single cell capture, right? Then, so conceivably, if you have enough genetic diversity, you could reconstruct a tree, right? But you know, from the other branch of the same experiment, you would know what expression the level diversity is. Is that an expensive experiment?
That would be an expensive experiment. I guess my question is, do you think you could, because in the xenograph setting, you potentially don't have to be satisfied with a snapshot, right? You can actually generate the data. Do you think you could generate rules that would allow you to predict what's going to happen from a snapshot when you impose therapy, so that you in your computational model for tumor board, you have your snapshot picture, you have a set of rules that you've established through experimentation based on xenograph type experiments that now allow you to say, given this snapshot, here's what I think is most likely to be the outcome.
One of the things that we can do with in breast cancer, and this is a separate topic, but we can take an initial sample and look for P-glycoprotein, which is essentially the dominant mechanism of adaptation, at least in some populations. And we can estimate, well, we can measure that in the population prior to the therapy. And so we could say, this a priori, this is the population that's going to be resistant. Mm-hmm. And then we can start from that point. I mean, that's pretty simplistic, but that's at least something. It's remarkable how quickly cells can adapt and change, and so that they can change their their expression profiles virtually in seconds. If you take the same population and put it in two different animals, you get remarkably different, yes. Microarray data. And you get that 2 days after you put them in. We could take the same tumor cell grow in a spheroid, and we find extraordinary. So we take an MCF7 cells, ER positive cells, put them in a spheroid, and we find that within the spheroid there are cells that are not expressing estrogen receptor anymore. That's within 24 hours of putting them all in this where they all express estrogen receptor. So
maybe put another way, along the lines of what we were talking about last night, if you assumed for a minute that the clone that is going to recur and ultimately kill you is the one that's completely insensitive to whatever environment you place it into, it's adaptable, right? It doesn't matter where it is. Would there be a signature of that kind of flexibility that you could detect through experimentation? So you could empirically potentially identify what those clones are with repeated patient specimens and repeated xenotransplantation. You might be able to actually identify what that phenotypically and genetically and epigenetically looks like in a way that you might be able to determine at the time of diagnosis that there's a population that has the signature of, multi-adaptability.
that's a word.
I'm not clear. I wasn't close enough to you guys to listen to much of the conversation, but it's not clear to me why those should be the cells that that kill you.
Because they're always fit. It doesn't matter what you do.
But in fact, it's enough to be fit in the environment of the drugs that are coming. You don't need to also be fit in a half a dozen other environments.
But I think the idea that you're fit in half a dozen other environments makes you distinct from those that are not.
Increases the probability.
Right, it just increases the probability that anything you do is not going to touch their fitness.
You have a greater capacity to be, if you have a greater plasticity.
Right.
Yeah, it's a good hypothesis. Mm-hmm.
But if the mechanism changes epigenetic, then I guess you could possibly measure that.
Yeah.
So.
It seems to me you could argue that cell population has access, very rapid access to the human genome. Every component
every
of the genome
is
available to it.
Interesting.
So in that setting, I mean, the human genome is this vast information storage house.
Yes.
And we focus on mutations, but in fact within our genome.
Yeah.
Are lots of strategies to overcome lots of things, and the ability to access quickly and express appropriate phenotypic properties, one could argue, is, I think how I would tend to approach it. I wonder whether the genetic piece of this is in cancer is as important as
the
ability to access what's in the genome.
And John Dick has a nice paper from last year that shows genetically identical clones that are epigenetically distinct and selected for in some single cell level data. And that's used exactly that. So it's certainly, it's the sort of marketing view versus the adaptive adaptation versus the inheritance and selection.
Really nice way to look at it. It's funny because I was at a conference recently where people first went around and described themselves, and one guy said he got up and said, well, he thinks that it's an emerging truth is that the traditional view of cancer's evolution with mutation and selection is wrong, and that it's all about applying developmental pathways. And of course, he has the traditional view of evolution, which is it's all about mutations. And in a broader view of evolution, it's really about expressing adaptive strategies. You don't necessarily need mutations. But I think he's correct in that sense that developmental pathways from embryology, can become very valuable. That's still evolution. It's
sure, but does it have to be one or the other? I mean, I think there's probably some genetic component. There's probably an epigenetic component.
Maybe this is why we see lots of mutations in chromatin remodelers, right? Maybe they're opening up epigenetic instability, which then allows for these, the population to be sort of super adaptable in the way you're describing.
Yeah,
like the genome's accessible, but different cells.
Right. So it's interesting that I said this yesterday that when we were doing the xenografts, where they took samples from lung cancers and grew them in nude mice, that what they found was that just the ability of those cells to grow in nude mice indicated a very poor prognosis for the patient. So the adaptability that you talked about, that may be a measure of it.
And it's interesting that I never thought about development, applying the idea that a undifferentiated cell is actually potentially being selected for in its differentiation by its ability to adapt to its environment. So the notion that cancer is, bringing you back to a primitive state, developmentally primitive state, I guess could also, correct me if you think I'm wrong, could also include the idea that you're that pluripotency includes the pluripotency of adaptation to specific environments. You can become an ovarian cell or a brain cell or a heart cell, and in each case you've had to adapt to a different environment. So in the cancer sense, getting back to that state makes you resistant to things. That is that?
Yeah, I think so. And then the question is whether we can take these properties and turn them on the tumor.
Right.
So its plasticity may be in some ways a if you could make that into a negative. So for example, do an initial therapy that moves, you know, causes it to move in one direction, and then very rapidly apply, you know, a second one where now you take these very strategic approaches where you're constantly varying therapy. And it's funny because we tend to take the same thing, you know, if you get a response to drug X, what we do is we keep giving drug X. Of course, all we're doing is selecting for resistance at that point. We should probably stop drug X at that point and give something else, but it's not traditionally, you know, done in that way. So this idea of varying very rapidly, you know, using very different therapy, but thinking about it as an evolutionary process.
In this developmental biology thread, what of the things, like I know, like P53 mutants or P53 deleted animals are non-viable, right? Is that correct?
Yeah.
So there's
do
we have a catalog of, you know, development, well, of, we'll call them central genes, I don't care what to call them, and how when they developmentally result in failed development, going back to what you're saying, what are those, which ones are those? Do we have a good catalog of what that is? Some sort of...
That's an interesting idea. So just everything that results in failed development?
Yeah. Because it speaks directly to this developmental, like, how do we stop development from doing what development does?
Yeah.
Well, we've done it very successfully, but we're trying to get around it instead of using that information. It's like throwaway information, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure you could. I've never heard anybody just compile the catalog of all, basically embryonic lethal.
We've done, so one of the things that our model suggested is we've sort of looked at this, and we always talk about what's the passenger mutations, the one that's sort of null. And then we look at the ones that are more common, and that's evolutionary triage. And those are interesting. You can model those, but what's interesting is the ones on this side, because those mutations unconditionally decrease fitness. And what we find is those are our best targets. So we've called them never mutations. And there's actually 1,100 of them in the TCGA database. And 1,100 genes are never observed to be mutated in cancer. One would argue that now a lot of them are just plain lethal to everything, but there may be mutations that are never seen in cancer, but not necessarily lethal to a mature
adult. Sorry,
Bob,
but I just wanted to understand the context. 1,100 out of the 20,000 genes in the human genome?
In the TCGA. Are not a single time in any of the patients, the 4,000 something.
So a natural analysis that occurs to me would be to look for variation in those genes, let's say among primates, just natural variation, to pull those two components apart. That could go very quickly.
And some of this goes to if you take the EGFR pathway, you know, EGFR is an oncogene, RAS is an oncogene, RAF is an oncogene. That is never an oncogene.
Yeah.
We actually looked at that, and that's true. In the TCGA database, MEK/NRF are not never mutations, but they're very rare. So one of the questions is why is that? What does that tell us about what you need?
Well, I might be derailing things, but P53. How many? What percentage of tumors?
It varies by tumor type.
But like. Got it, gut?
20%.
Only 20% have something wrong with
your thinking? Well, the pathway is dysregulated in all of cancer. I mean, mutation, deletion of P53 itself, but then loss of ARF or amplification of MDM2 functionally in the activator. And the mutations are gain of function. I mean, they're loss of normal function, but they're frequently gain of other function. They're very complicated in terms of their effect. So the mutated P53 is most commonly transcriptionally active. It's just its targets are different than normal. So very different than loss of function and very different from ARF loss and MPM2 amplification. But the pathway is always inactivated.
The pathway is always inactivated.
I mean, generally speaking, it's always in there.
But it's doing something
but
else.
But it's doing something else. It's gaining.
Only in the P53 mutant, which is the infrequent, that's the 20%. So the P53 mutant, it's doing something else. All the other ones, it's just loss of function.
So how many of those never mutations are ones that developmentally you can't succeed in making a creature with them?
That's the best thing to do right now. But it's not, I mean, in E. coli, you can't mutate about 10% of the genes. You can't, meaning that if you mutate them, they you don't see any cells.
But you could take from that pile, though. You could take the ones that there is something known about the fact that you can't.
I think we have to be a little bit careful. I think the key is it's now looking that the synthetic lethality idea is always conditional.
There have been several things in different, and it's funny because it's different in different environments.
Yeah.
Which again is interesting because it would suggest that each tumor may be unique, or even subpopulations may be unique, but again, in identifying potential targets, this may be kind of a different strategy that might be useful. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we find is that if you attack the never mutation, the population that emerges is often very rich in driver, what are more classical driver phenotypes, and can be as extremely vulnerable then to the more traditional targeted therapy. So again, computationally, we can actually eradicate tumor population, very heterogeneous tumor populations with high frequency by combining those sequentially, those therapies. So again, I don't know, we'll see. We can't even get the damn paper published, so.
Is there any correlation between those genes that are never mutations and their polymorphic variation compared to genes that are mutated?
You're already way more sophisticated than I am.
No, that was the question that I was. Yeah. Right. Are they variable in natural populations?
Right.
And are they variable in related species relative to human? Yes,
yeah, so we have a. That's a level of sophistication that's far beyond me. We do have a bioinformatics guy that's actually starting to look at these, look at the pathways that are involved, and hopefully he'll tease out something. And
what's the company you get all the animals, the mice from? You need mice.
Oh yeah, the Nuck.
Jackson.
So Jax has a phenome database that should allow you to scan for what's embryonically.
Yeah.
I actually think that's a really cool idea.
Have your informatics dude check that out.
It's already a bit crabby.
Oh, darn thing you need to
post that. Well, he's not overly enthusiastic.
Does he want a job?
With you? No, not.
No.
I think you answered that question. It's become clear. We tried that, and so I have to tell you, I outsmarted a tumor, I think. And I was like, I can't tell you what a warm and fuzzy feeling this gives me, but MCF7 cells, are breast cancer, they are ER positive, and we made this observation that under hypoxic conditions, they are ER negative. They just completely stop expressing it. And it takes about 24 hours for them to stop expressing it, and about 48 hours to re-express it. So, the hypothesis was that in hypoxia, they can't, if they try to proliferate, there's not enough substrate available, and so it'll be a lethal outcome. So the downregulation is the equivalent of a never mutation in that sense. So any upregulation of it would be lethal. So we gave them tamoxifen, which upregulates estrogen receptor, took it away, and then put them in different environments, including estrogen and hypoxia, and they all died. Like, I outsmarted them.
Actually, that reminds me, speaking of estrogen receptors, reminds me of something that I learned at Tumor Board, which is an ER-positive tumor is not 100% expressing the receptor.
Yeah, and that's where some of this comes from. So is that because, is there a different population that they don't use estrogen receptor, or is it because they're in hypoxic regions and that they would have, and because of that, they simply stopped expressing it, although genetically they're exactly the same. I mean, it's just,
so would that argue that like estrogen receptor positivity would be more likely to mets to the lung? I don't know if Bresco's lung is versus like, or brain, those would be more likely to be estrogen receptor positive, whereas something to, something else that would be less vascular would be negative? Is that association known? Because the, you know, like with fluoroestradiol PET imaging, you would look at, look at macroscopic measures. I just don't know if anything's correlated where the met is to some perception of how vascular, therefore likelihood of it being not a hypoxic case. Or overlaying F-miso and F-fluoroestradiol.
Yeah, so we did, there's a longer story behind this. We've been looking at estrogen receptor as a mark, we've been looking at poor perfusion on MRI scans as a marker for estrogen receptor. So tumors that are poorly perfused don't express estrogen receptor, and that actually is true. But of course, I screwed this one up. My hypothesis was that since estrogen's in the blood, that you wouldn't express estrogen receptor if estrogen was not present. So hence so poor blood flow, no ER, and it turns out that's wrong. It appears to be hypoxia. If you take these cells and take estrogen totally out of the environment, which is hard to do, they continue to express estrogen receptor. But if you make them hypoxic, they don't. So it was sort of the right answer for the wrong. Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I thought
that was a good reason.
The thing that I was thinking about was, is the immunohistochemistry that the pathologist can do. Poor man's version of the experiment that Boris wants. So we can look at expression of one gene, and is that an example of a phenotype that partitions the population of cells in response to ecological opportunities, or is it some kind of transient thing, or is that a kind of the beginning of a toehold to get into some of these questions that we were outlining earlier this morning?
And actually, is it also insight into the kind of flexibility we were talking about adaptation? So if you see no variation in the expression of something critically important, does that suggest an inflexibility that might correlate with better response? Whereas, adaptation to particular niches would suggest that it's going to be a more resistant.
Yeah. You could have a different strategy in that group than one that's very, very plastic.
Experimental metrics for things like plasticity or adaptability. Are there ways to quantify that in this movement?
Not that I've heard, but this sounds like a way that you could, if you knew that genetically all those cells were the same. But that phenotypically they were not. That's a measure of flexibility, right?
Yeah.
So the data are there.
See, a new metric just arrived. Yeah. Look at that. Deliverables.
I mean, that would actually be a really interesting study to do.
So how would I think you'd proceed?
Well, I would think that you would, this is probably very simple-minded, but if you could sequence and know what the most common mutations were, let's say, and then do immunohistochemistry for the protein product of that gene, and you knew that every cell in that tumor had that mutation, but the expression of that protein was highly variable, that would be a measure of flexibility.
Mm-hmm. So my point would be to, since blood flow in tumors is often sporadic and heterogeneous and stochastic, my approach would be to take the tumors and simply put them in a oxygen chamber and have it stochastically varying oxygen and then see what comes out of it.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking what the pathologist could do. Yeah. Like at the time of diagnosis, what would be clinically feasible to generate a metric like that as part of the equation that you would use in your, computational computation.
And it would be interesting to see how things like, these population studies then play out with, put sums with and narrow then, yes, and then yeah, wider yeah. And throw them all in dish and say, go, and see what happens.
Exactly.
Throw them in an animal.
I mean, because that's the snapshot that potentially you're going to predict
and then
from, right?
The evolutionary prediction would be the wider that distribution of phenotypes observed in the single cell level would be the one that wins the game.
That's right, and the more genes and proteins you can examine in that fashion, in that same specimen, the more multidimensional you could make that fitness or that flexibility.
It strikes me that that's the kind of data that it's like Susan and I were talking about this whole throwaway data thing, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Failure stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It strikes me that that's probably sitting in somebody's freezer right now, and we just don't have numbers on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, suppose you took a population, put it in hypoxia, and then put it in normoxia, and simply looked at expression variation. Would the ability to adapt represent a measure of plasticity? It doesn't have to be epoxy, but just something like that, where you put them in very different environments and look at how well they can maintain their fitness through a quick rearrangement of their.
So you're thinking like the sort of the epigenetic short-term plasticity versus fixated F1 alpha sort of story.
I mean, you wouldn't anticipate that normal cells could adapt rapidly to that, right? But you know that cancer cells, for the most part, can, right? They can grow under hypoxia. So in that regard,
So is morphologically what we observe is primitive cells, the ones that are...
So that's what I was just trying to think through. When, thinking through the way the pathologist, will call something polyphenotypic or they're primitive, and, the primitive frequently will express multiple lineage markers, right? So I don't know if you see this in adults as much as kids, but neural tumors, like medulloblastoma, will frequently have astrocytic or even oligodendrocytic components as part of what used to contribute to that diagnosis of primitive neuroectodermal tumor, which now has specific entities to it. But by its very, in just this way, it was a tumor in which there were subpopulations of cells that had very different protein expression. I mean, identifiable with, just standard antibodies, and those are difficult to treat tumors.
So along these lines, I guess going back to the previous suggestion of looking at the adaptability. So did anyone ever compare these some genetically unstable lines sort of versus already restabilized, perhaps, sort of aneuploid, messed up cancer lines as to their adaptability, right? So an obvious hypothesis is, of course, that if you catch them before they fix their telomerase, they would be more adaptable. Of course, the challenge then is, how does one even begin to enumerate, parameterize, select, control sort of different environments. One sort of needs to come up with some sort of sensible panel of growth conditions And that would seem to be the difficult part of the problem, just deciding what one tests in. But otherwise, one just grows it in whatever 1,000 role plays. So.
Yeah, I like the idea. It almost goes back to the way that the old infection diagnosis used to be made, right? By plating something on multiple plates and
Joe was talking about, that they have.
Right, you could do the same potentially with tumor cell isolates.
Now they've been, it's been done, right? The SAMS, salmon cell assay or stem cell assay, this in myeloma was done years ago.
I don't know.
Am I the only one old enough to remember this? Apparently so.
There's several companies in California. They send their tumor tissues and they'll culture them and do screening.
For what?
Drugs. Breast cancer specific drugs, lung cancer specific.
Right. So,
but is there a way of designing some sort of panel of conditions?
But it didn't work. Salmon cell assay did not work. It was abandoned. So just to complete the story, if you didn't respond in vitro, you didn't respond in vivo. But if you did respond in vitro, more than half the time did you respond in vivo. So, speaking to heterogeneity in the tumor, so it's not just conditions, but sometimes the drug dose, for example, cannot be, a lethal dose cannot be achieved because of blood flow. The tumor itself is so heterogeneous in its environment, it's hard to.
But a good condition to test would be hypoxia to normoxia, some gradient of hypoxia to normoxia.
Sort
of this changing environment. Right. But that would be a very typical one that the tumor would actually be experiencing.
In myeloma, we have to put in mesenchymal cells because they shield the tumor cells from cytotoxics. And so, maybe I've showed that, but what we do is look at IC55 using these microfluidics. So you have drug flowing from here into here, and you put the cells in that, and you see where that they die. But if you put the patient's mesenchymal cells into that, it screws the whole thing up. That needing way more drug to kill them. So then you have to take that, look at the bone marrow morphology from the biopsy, look at the vascular density, calculate what you think is going to be the amount of drug that is received, look for the mesenchymal cells and see how much of the population is immediately adjacent to a mesenchymal cells and they're going to be relatively resistant. If you want to do this sort of a calculation, modeling the likelihood of resistance and heterogeneity of resistance, that's sort of at least what you have to do.
Well, I was wondering if there's a biochemical marker for that proximity, for that anatomical proximity.
Fibrinogen.
Could you use something as a proxy to something?
Yes, you can use fibrinogen, so you can stain for that. That's actually what we do, rather than as I'm looking specifically for
example. Okay.
I have a sort of naive question, which is there a model that we can use in between for drug resistance? So they think about the program and at the beginning of this discussion and the article you put up and correspondence with what Sourav is showing, we have single cellular organisms, right? Unicellular organisms where we study drug resistance or we study experimental evolution or we study adaptability. And then on the other extreme, we have cancer and all the complexity. And so for some of the bigger questions that we're talking about with cancer and ecological niches and adaptability, is there some place in between where we can perhaps gain some insight?
So we have a study that hopefully you'll be impressed soon, in which we co-cultured glioblastoma cells and primary human brain microvascular endothelial cells in Matrigel, and that endothelial cells, when they're in the Matrigel, set up a lattice that looks capillary-like, so there's a spatial organization to the dish. And the tumor cells will localize to the endothelial cells, and then actually they undergo shape changes and all kinds of other things. But the point is that we did a compound library screen with tumor cell monocultures and then tumor cell co-cultures, and found two classes of really interesting hits in this screen. So one was the drugs that had absolutely no effect on tumor cells in monoculture, but significantly blocked all of the pro-tumor growth interactions of endothelial cells with tumor cells. There were only, out of the 2,000 compounds we screened, there were only four drugs that were able to do that, and three of them have in vivo activity. So they have no direct effect on tumor cells, but they block the way that endothelial cells and tumor cells interact, and two of them actually have quite significant in vivo activity. But the other class of drugs were drugs that were highly toxic to tumor cell monocultures, and then had no activity along the lines that you're talking about when you co-cultured them. And among them were a number of cytotoxic agents that, you know, in previous history screened in monoculture screens were tried in patients and had minimal activity because the environment provides sanctuary against those compounds. So one, I think you can do these things in a hopefully in a meaningful way. I mean, I think the in vivo results suggest that you can do them in a meaningful way that do capture some of the microenvironmental attributes that provide resistance and allow you to study the mechanisms which potentially get at these flexibility adaptation kinds of questions. But I think, you know, before when I was suggesting that multiple culture conditions, I think you can do that with multiple conditions, hypoxia being one of them, and you could throw in necrotic material and ask, you know, what that does, because, I mean, there's a perinecrotic domain, and we've put in pericytes, which change everything again, and I think you can generate in vitro models that capture the idea that tumors have to adapt to multiple environments in order to be successful.
So one thing we're doing this with myeloma is giving them melphalan, which is a standard cytotoxic drug, and their EMDR, environmental media drug resistance, where they attack to fibrinogen or mesenchymal cells, keeps them from basically salvages them. And we now have a drug called HIT-1 that selectively targets cells that are bound to, and the goal being to push them into this adaptive strategy, and then hit the adaptive strategy as a sort of second line.
Yeah.
Now you could imagine you could start doing this evolutionary feudal cycle where you're now selecting out for ones that aren't attached and therefore vulnerable to melphalan. I mean, you could play endless, potentially endless games, and obviously as long as you're in the game, the patient's alive. You know, that's the sort of goal. Is you just
can we at this point have a discussion of him? I think this is it's a good friend.
That's a nice idea.
Yeah.
So why don't we get some coffee before they close the kitchen for the next 2 weeks? and we'll do the last ones in there.
Smart idea.
Yeah.